From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
News that the U.S. Supreme Court may strike down Roe v. Wade is roiling the nation and the state of Florida. We'll have team coverage on what it all means.
The privacy clause doesn't explicitly use the word abortion, so I think that's where the discrepancy comes in.
Also this week, it seems the abortion issue isn't only of interest to women of childbearing age.
But there are older people out here like me, too, who had friends maybe that even died or something awful happened to them.
We'll also peel back the layers of the takeover of Florida's county health departments by the state's Department of Health not too long ago. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Of course, the leaked draft opinion about Roe v. Wade from the U.S. Supreme Court was the top story of the week. We're following up with several reports. Abortion advocates rallied outside the state Supreme Court in Tallahassee on Tuesday of this week. Regan McCarthy reports the crowd gathered in response to that draft opinion that was leaked from the Supreme Court that would overturn Roe v. Wade. Regan McCarthy says that would return decisions about abortion to the states.
Abortion bans have got to go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! Abortion
Protesters outside the state Supreme Court are holding signs that say things like bans off our bodies and our bodies, our choice. It's been a stormy day, but the crowd isn't deterred. Melanie Andrade Williams has just finished speaking to the more than 100 people gathered. She's a legislative manager with the Florida Alliance of Planned Parenthood affiliates. She says overturning Roe v. Wade could have widespread impacts.
Should they overrule Roe v. Wade, 26 states already are poised to ban or restrict abortion in some way. So restriction is much like what you see what happened here with the 15-week ban.
Andrade Williams is talking about a bill signed into law last month by Governor Ron DeSantis. It would ban most abortions after 15 weeks. If the court overturns Roe v. Wade, that would remove some potential constitutional snags for the measure on a federal level. But the new law could face a constitutional challenge on the state level. The state constitution has a privacy clause that has been used in the past to support access to abortion up to the point of viability. But if it faces a challenge in court, Andrade Williams admits the new, more conservative justices on the state court could overturn that ruling as well.
The privacy clause doesn't explicitly use the word abortion, so I think that's where the discrepancy comes in.
The new law goes into effect July 1st. Advocates have already vowed to fight it. But for now, Andrade Williams says,
as of now, abortion is legal. I think there's confusing messaging out there, but today abortion is legal in Florida up to 24 weeks, up to viability. And it will be. And Planned Parenthood, you know, we're going to keep fighting no matter what that looks like.
I'm Regan McCarthy.
Now that the figurative cat is out of the bag regarding the probable direction of the Supreme Court on the abortion issue, what might happen next? Sarah Mueller takes a look.
Hundreds of people recently gathered in front of the Florida Supreme Court to protest a leak opinion striking down Roe v. Wade. Marina Pecorino, a 38-year-old Tallahassee resident, says she was devastated when she learned of the leaked draft opinion.
I cried, and then I yelled, and then I cried some more.
Pecorino said she almost needed an abortion 4 years ago when she was pregnant with her son. While she was relieved her situation happened before the draft opinion came down, she worries about what could happen if women don't have the right to have an abortion. In the draft opinion striking down Roe, Justice Samuel Alito argues abortion is not a right because it is not specifically mentioned in the U.S. Constitution. University of Miami law professor Caroline Corbin says the Constitution protects certain rights not specifically mentioned in the document.
And among these unenumerated rights are a group of rights known under the umbrella term as the right to privacy.
The right to privacy has been used to pave the way for other pivotal U.S. Supreme Court decisions, like the right for interracial marriage, like the right for interracial marriage and same-sex marriage. And it's here where people like Todd Delmay worry the nation's high court could invalidate their marriages. Delmay and his husband Jeff were one of the first same-sex couples in Florida to marry after the state's ban was ruled unconstitutional in 2015.
My husband and I are an interracial couple as well. And again, it's just this insidious creep of a conservative radicalism that is affecting the courts.
Delmay is currently running for the Florida House. Florida still has a ban on same-sex marriage in the state. And Delmay worries the U.S. Supreme Court could target another key case next, the one that paved the way for gay marriage.
If Obergefell were to fall, then Amendment 2, which again was added in 2008, would again be the law of the land, and it would be enforced. And I think that's part of why they've been unwilling to remove it. We've asked them, like I said, for years.
Under that scenario, Florida's ban would once again go into effect because the state legislature never removed it from the state constitution. Supreme Court Justices Clarence Thomas and Alito have called for the court to revisit Obergefell. Longtime abortion rights advocates fear a return to pre-Roe days where women would have abortions illegally, often at the risk of their own lives.
A lot of women died, you know, and we've all heard the stories. There are probably a lot of people out here. People are young, but there are older people out here like me, too, who had friends maybe that even died or something awful happened to them.
Barbara Devane is a longtime lobbyist for women's rights issues. And she's been working in that space since before abortion became legal. So has Jacksonville civil rights attorney Betsy White. Her late husband, Bill Shepard, was part of an underground network, pre-Roe, that would help women in Florida obtain abortions in New York.
They were threatened with prosecution, and my husband said, bring it on. And of course, that was just another hollow threat.
If the U.S. Supreme Court goes with Alito's justification for overturning Roe, it could jeopardize Florida's constitutional protections. The Florida state constitution has a guaranteed right to privacy, and the Florida Supreme Court has historically used that right to privacy to block legislative efforts to restrict abortion in the state. Recently, Governor Ron DeSantis approved a 15-week abortion. It will likely be challenged and end up before the Florida court. University of Miami law professor Corbin says now that Florida's high court is more conservative, it'll likely take note of the U.S. Supreme Court's move.
The Florida Supreme Court, in deciding that case, may reinterpret the right to privacy in a way that affects abortion more generally.
I'm Sarah Mueller.
Overturning Roe v. Wade would give states the ability to severely restrict access to abortion or even ban it outright. Abortion rights advocates are worried this will happen in states like Florida if the U.S. Supreme Court sticks with that draft opinion on the Mississippi abortion case that was leaked this week. As Valerie Crowder reports, the rolling back of a constitutionally protected right to abortion is likely to benefit Democrats.
Tallahassee resident Katie Kyle was among about 200 people who gathered outside the Florida Supreme Court Tuesday to rally for abortion rights. Kyle says she had an emotional reaction after learning the U.S. Supreme Court will likely overturn Roe v. Wade.
So mad. So mad. I have an 18-year-old daughter, and I just never thought this day would come.
Kyle says she has very little trust in the impartiality of the U.S. Supreme Court after learning about the majority's arguments against reproductive freedom.
It really appears to be very partisan and very, I believe this to be settled precedent, and it's apparently not.
Justice Samuel Alito wrote the draft opinion. In it, he writes, quote, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. Henrietta Shino is a political scientist at University of North Florida. She says that's very strong language.
What I think it is going to do is reduce people's trust in the judicial branch of the government, because we are seeing justices of the current court doubting the decisions of justices that ruled in the past.
A recent UNF survey shows most Florida voters do not support a recently enacted state ban on most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. University of Washington political scientist Sophia Jordan Wallace says a rolling back of a constitutionally protected right to abortion could give Democrats running in swing districts a helpful boost in the midterm elections.
This could mobilize certain segments of the Democratic base, but it could also mobilize independents in support of the Democratic Party, particularly in places where they're close, where it's close races.
Wallace says the ruling likely won't help Republicans and it could cost them votes. She says it's too early to know if this issue alone will drive some citizens to the polls or determine how they vote. I'm Valerie Crowder.
Still to come on Capitol Report, what some are still calling a hostile takeover of Florida's county health departments by state government a while back is actually having some negative impacts on public health.
And all of a sudden now, the small 30 to 60 to 90 bed hospitals disappear.
And we'll hear from some actual teachers in response to the question, how's your morale nowadays?
Look, I'm going to put the kid first. Now I have to go and tell you what day and what I did, as opposed to a generalized statement.
In the era of COVID-19, public health decisions for things like mandatory masking and how long someone could quarantine after exposure are all controlled by the Florida state government. But not too long ago, county governments were able to set their own policies. So, what changed? That's the topic of the latest episode of WLRN's podcast, Tallahassee Takeover. In the following excerpt, WLRN's Veronica Zaragovia and Danny Rivero told us the long history of public health in Florida, starting with the creation of county health departments in the late 1960s.
Public health in Florida went from being highly centralized to highly decentralized. And along with this was the creation of local health departments. Every county had their own local health department. And these new health departments played a huge role in people's lives.
I was born and raised 90 miles from here in Glades County, which is considered a rural county and still is a rural county. So I grew up in a very small town in a class of 13.
Annie Niesman would grow up to lead the biggest county health department in Florida. She was the director of the Dade County Health Department from 1990 to 2000. And today, she is the CEO of the Jesse Trice Community Health System in Miami.
There were 13 individuals in my classroom. And I knew the public health department back during my time as a child and as a teenager. That's where we received our health care. That's where we went to get our shots. At that time, we did have one doctor in the entire county, but most of the care that we received was from the public health department.
Niesman remembers what it was like when public health was a local thing, like in the aftermath of Hurricane Andrew 30 years ago. That hurricane completely devastated some parts of South Dade.
We knew from the Miami-Dade Public Health Department that we were in this for the long run. We set up tent cities. We set up medical units, medical tents. We set up what we call a chat teams, community health action teams that went door to door, assisting individuals with whatever their needs may have been. When the medical teams came in, we set up tent cities even for them.
Niesman remembers that the U.S. Army helped out for a few months.
And then we were on our own for at least a year, providing services for the individuals, the residents, and the visitors to South Miami-Dade County.
For the most part, the money for the Dade County Health Department and other public health agencies came from local taxpayers, even though the state did toss some money their way. county governments set up their own public health boards where they made rules and enforced things like restaurant inspections, mounted vaccination campaigns for diseases like smallpox, and they collected data about whooping cough.
We had a smallpox issue in our Haitian community during those early years. The public health department, had to do massive immunization for smallpox because a segment of our population had not been vaccinated. That was, that was a tremendous experience. Through those years, the Miami-Dade County officials, I believe, recognized the importance of public health because we certainly helped them with swimming. We helped them with all of the environmental issues. We did coordinate and always coordinated with the state in making sure that our response was one that was appropriate. And if we needed any state or regional resources, then we were able to pull from those resources.
Even though the county health departments were independent, they were still part of a statewide system. And this is going to sound wonky because it is, but the state was split up into 11 different districts.
I reported to that district administrator, and then that district administrator would filter up to Tallahassee.
At this time in the mid-1990s, Florida was controlled by Democrats, and Fred Lippman was a Democratic state representative from Broward County.
I've been involved in the political realm probably, Daniel, before you were born, since 1968. I was appointed to the Board of Commissioners of the South Broward Hospital District, which is Memorial System, back in 1968. So I've been around.
And Lippman says this decentralized system of public health was really starting to fall apart in the mid-1990s because the money mostly came from local tax dollars. You had rich counties and you had poor counties.
And it was during that period of time that a lot of rural hospitals were going out of business. Closing them. Don't forget, we have a huge state. I mean, our state, if you go from the Keys to Pensacola, you're halfway to Chicago. People don't realize how large our state is. There was this inconsistent, and I believe, in my mind, totally inappropriate and ineffective way to provide health care to all of the citizens of the state of Florida. You know, there were people that were going 80, 90 miles to get certain elements of healthcare, which you and I would take for granted.
So Lippman starts to make noise about this, and he says he had the ear of the Democratic governor at the time, Lawton Chiles. And he says the governor was receptive, and he wanted to pass a big reform.
You know, he understood it, and he came from some original stock of Florida. And all of a sudden now, the small 30 to 60 to 90 bed hospitals disappeared. Rather than relying upon just each county being either tax rich or tax poor and using monies and saying, well, we have to repair the sewer system, so therefore we won't take care of healthcare, or we have to do a road or a bridge and we're not going to do healthcare. That was unfair.
The idea that Lippman has is to create an entirely new Florida Department of Health, which would put everything that these local health departments did under one office.
These are things like monitoring water and air quality, trying to get rid of lead paint in housing, providing affordable cancer screenings, and getting people vaccinated, of course.
And under this new conception, local county departments of health would now fall under the state.
That was an excerpt from the latest episode of WLRN's podcast, Tallahassee Takeover. You can listen to the full episode wherever you get your podcasts. While we're on the subject of public health, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that fewer children are getting routine vaccinations required to enter school. Health News Florida's Katrine Pruner sat down with Jill Roberts, a professor of public health at the University of South Florida, to discuss reasons for the decline.
I think there are multiple factors. One part of it is that we have less people going to do primary care. And so if you're a parent during this time period, in order to take your child into the doctor's office, you had to make a choice. Is it worth the chance that there could be kids there that have COVID? In which case, you could be putting your kid at risk. The other factor, of course, is that school was mostly online. And so school will require you to bring a health record in for your child to enroll or to continue in school, but they were at home. So there was nothing driving those wellness checks. So then, unfortunately, the other factor is probably vaccine hesitancy. It's not the first time we've seen hesitancy. It's been around, but it was much more quiet in the past. COVID vaccine hesitancy really blew up and kind of met a national stage unlike it's ever seen before.
Do you think misinformation or anti-vaccine campaigns in Florida may have played a part in fewer children getting routine vaccinations?
Yeah, I'm sure that this is true. And it's not just Florida. It's a nationwide problem. So what's different about COVID is people put it in a different category. So they see children actually getting COVID and recovering and seemingly fine. Now, we don't know the long-term impacts of getting COVID. So in their minds, COVID does not equal polio and all these other diseases that we vaccinated for. And so this hesitancy really kind of grew up to say, well, maybe we don't need this. Maybe this is a mild disease. Maybe I'm putting my child at risk. If you put that little amount of doubt in there, people who push anti-vax campaigns will jump on it in a heartbeat.
Thousands of children in Florida already received religious exemptions that allowed them to forgo required vaccines for school. And national data shows more people may be applying for and getting these exemptions. Why could that be an issue?
Yeah, so this is unfortunate. To put some data behind it, there are no major religions that oppose vaccination. In fact, some of the biggest vaccination campaigns in the world are actually led by faith leaders. However, it's a loophole. And so individuals who really don't want to vaccinate, but they still want their kids to go to school, or they still want to get that job, or whatever it is that's the barrier, will jump on that.
What percentage of children need to be vaccinated to prevent outbreaks?
So being a public health practitioner, I say all of them. To answer scientifically, it's really high. In order for us to prevent measles, we have to hit a 95% threshold. In fact, the goal for 2030 is 90%. We were there. So before this last year, we were at 95% of children getting their vaccinations. Why it's so high is measles. Nothing spreads like measles. Now, we've seen coronavirus maybe give it a run for its money, but measles was the big barrier where we said, okay, we've got to get all these people vaccinated.
Do you know if Florida has done anything to boost vaccination rates over the past few years?
I'd say we've done the opposite, unfortunately. And so we've gone against national guidelines that recommend vaccinations in the state of Florida. And so that's unfortunate. I haven't yet seen any official notification against any vaccine other than COVID. Now, obviously, with COVID, we've gone against what has been recommended nationwide. But for other vaccines, as far as I know, we're still towing the same line as what the CDC recommendations are.
Do you think COVID has permanently changed the way many people perceive vaccinations?
Yeah, I think COVID actually brought a lot of shift in things and shift in thinking and in ways that aren't necessarily great. And so when everyone asks me the question, what is my risk? I'd say, no, what's the community's risk? Because you are not safe if we do not vaccinate the community, because I can't guarantee you that vaccine was 100%. So you got to have everyone around you be vaccinated to prevent. And so what COVID has done is really shifted from that community mindset to a me, individual, freedom mindset. And so I think that COVID shifted things badly and in a way that's dangerous. It's dangerous for the individual and it's dangerous for the community.
That was USF Professor Jill Roberts speaking with Health News Florida's Katrine Bruner. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida has made several new laws regarding education this year. WUSF recently asked teachers if these laws help or hurt their efforts in the classroom, what their current challenges are, and why some are leaving the profession. Here's what some told them about the rising workload and a crisis in morale.
My name is Melissa Hall, and I teach high school social studies, and I'm in Hillsborough County Schools. We've probably had 7 or 8 teachers leave mid-year. a lot of schools are having that same problem. Some of our classes are incredibly large. So, for example, it's not uncommon for me to have a class of 34 students, and I have the smaller classes in many cases. I have colleagues who have 36, 37, 38. We have a lot of very devoted educators who are suffering from a morale crisis. And I would argue that 90% of it, it has nothing to do with what happens in our classrooms. A lot of people say, well, oh, it's because teachers don't make enough money. Guess what? We've never made enough money. I mean, that's not news. Nobody really goes into teaching going, you know what? I think I'm going to be rich doing this. And I would argue that the majority of us realize that we could take other jobs that would pay more money. So I don't think we can put it as just teacher pay. Okay. I don't think we can put it as just larger class sizes. But I think at the same time, it's when you add up all these small things where it's like you're being asked to do more with less every single time. It seems like every year we're pretty much promised that next year is going to be harder. And then this domino effect starts. So somebody says, enough is enough, I'm leaving. And then the next one says, well, you know what? If Ms. Smith's leaving, well, I bet you I could probably leave too.
My name is Steve Conover. I teach algebra at a public charter school in Hillsborough County. So it just seems like everything is speeding up, getting faster and faster, more immediate responses, not just to classroom material with students, but also with administration and with what the state's requiring us to do. It just seems to get a larger and larger amount of things. And really, we can't spend the time decently on any of them. So the laws that are being passed both federally and state level that my school has to, you know, honor and obey with, they're getting more detailed oriented. And sometimes it was more of a, look, I'm going to put the kid first. Now I have to go and tell you what day and what I did, as opposed to a generalized statement. It's the documentation of work. For us to teach and to do all of our things here, I cannot get it done in my, I hate to say contracted hours, but it's very hard for me not to take things home and do work at home. And then my own family and my own mental health is going to pay for that.
My name is Aline Logis. I teach 11th and 12th grade and also freshman at Robinson High School in Hillsborough County. Like almost every teacher I know takes work home. They stay up late grading. My husband teaches at another school in the district, and he stays up late grading. He stays up late planning. It impacts our personal lives. And we're paid hourly, so we're only paid for the hours that we're at school. So anything we do beyond the school day, we're basically doing on our own dime. And I take a lot of issue with that. That's one of the main reasons I've considered leaving the profession in the past. And like I said, during COVID, it was like, oh my God, teachers are amazing. And then once it was time to get back into the classroom, people were pushing for teachers to get back in the classroom when the COVID rates were still high, which ended up being okay. But it felt like we weren't as valued, that our lives didn't even matter at that point. So it kind of hurts that people don't seem to value us that much.
That teacher morale postcard was prepared by the staff of WUSF in Tampa. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Valerie Crowder, Gina Jordan, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Brett Rutherford. Thanks also to Sarah Mueller, Veronica Zarakovia, Danny Rivero, and Katrine Bruner. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.